March the 13th, about 8:31. In attendance of the resource committee, we have Representative Herman, Cato, Pierce, Miller, Sun, and Schultz. At this time also, we have joining us at this meeting, Oil and Gas, Special Committee on Oil and Gas, Representative Davis and Cotton. I believe I saw someone else walk in, but I'm not sure. The first bill that we're going to be hearing today is Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 152, an act related to the extension and renewal of certain sales of state royalty oil. And at this time, I would like to, and this bill is sponsored by Senator Coghill, and I would like to have Senator Coghill come forth at this time. Before we get started, Representative Thompson, Resource Committee, is also here, and then the Oil and Gas Committee, you have Representative Szymanski, and for show. Oh, Representative Cotton, I thought I mentioned for show.
But you had to.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 152 is introduced by myself in the Senate. The original bill was to review and recommend to the legislature to extend for 3 months the agreement for sale and purchase of the royalty oil between the state of Alaska and Golden Valley. And the committee substitute made it more constitutional, where that we didn't smack into the executive branch of administering an oil contract, and so the committee substitute has the repealer of the three sections and reenactment of the three sections. Golden Valley, which is the utility for the northern part of the Parks Highway and Richardson Highway, the Fairbanks area, extending from Delta all the way down into McKinley Park on the park side, negotiated an agreement for 5,000 barrels of royalty oil in 1976. Golden Valley didn't exercise this option until 1981. And what they have is they have turbine-type generation at the site of the North Pole refinery. The price discount over $500,000 a year is passed on to the 50,000 electric consumers. Department of Natural Resources indicated that the continued royalty oil sale to Golden Valley is in the best interest of the state, and in fact they have just negotiated a new contract, and this is an extension. And the reason for the vehicle of extension is that there is a term base that has to be extended between the time that the state of Alaska notifies the North Slope producers that they are going to fall a certain portion of their royalty oil that and goes back into the midstream of the line. The new contract with the state is a long-term, non-competitive contract for 10 years, and will be coming before the legislature. It must be signed by the governor and become effective a month after signing. The expiration date of the existing contract is June the 30th of 1985. As a part of the Prudhoe Bay Unit Agreement of April 1st, 1971, 90-day notice must be given to the producers to switch from an in-kind taking to a value for the same volume. And this is the foundation of what this bill is all about. We can't get the new contract before the legislature and to the governor and sign and be within that 90 days. So the utilities in the interior of Alaska may well be without the priority of this oil for as much as 45 to 60 days. So we made sure that we had enough time and we put in the 90 days. Essentially, with no extension of the oil, it would stop Golden Valley's use of this particular crude oil. I think that pretty much basically tells you what the whole foundation of the bill is. It passed the Senate with no negative votes.
If I may, We're also on teleconference here, and Kay Brown is in Anchorage. If there's anyone that, as we go along here, has any questions of her, she'll be standing by there to answer questions. This time, anyone have any questions of Senator Cogdell? Representative Sun.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, do we have anybody from Golden Valley to testify on this legislation here?
Mr. Chairman, make any inquiry. We have letters in our files on the Senate side that we could have for you. This is requested by Golden Valley's council that we do something like this in order to keep the continuity of the utility going. I might say that the Oil and Gas Division in the Attorney General's office, the people over in Natural Resources, all favored the bill that represented.
Representative Szymanski.
Hey, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, boy, I tell you, it's kind of early in the morning, huh?
Moving up.
Maybe we're just thinking about good thoughts, huh? Anyway, what I'd like to do is probably ask a question to Kay and then maybe go to the Senator. Kay, why didn't the administration advance this proposal, and why do we have it under such a time crunch at this stage of the game?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kay Brown with the Department of Natural Resources. The problem of the gap in the tagging results from our inability to complete the negotiations on the long-term contract in a timely way. It was apparent to us, as well as to the other parties to the negotiation, that we would, in fact, experience a gap, but nonetheless, we were at a very difficult sticking point, primarily regarding the Amerada Hess adjustments on that contract and how those were to be handled. When it became apparent that Golden Valley would not be able to continue to have that provision in their contract, we were sort of deadlocked for a while, and eventually that was resolved, and that is the reason that we're several months late getting down to the legislature with the contract. I think as far as why we didn't advance that, we felt that the timeline was known and that the consequences would be borne by the people responsible for the breakdown in communications there. But as the commissioner has previously testified, we don't have any objection to the extension, and the senator is correct that we have supported this bill in the Senate.
In follow-up to that, Mr. Chairman, are you saying then that the parties involved in this negotiation, predominantly GVA, was really at fault for the breakdown in the negotiations from your perspective?
Well, no, sir, not only GVEA, but also MAPCO and the state. There were really three parties to the negotiations. And so eventually MAPCO did agree to pick up those Amerada Hess adjustments. Representing the state's interests, we felt that it was important to remain whole on the price term and that we were not willing to give up the amount we would have received plus the 30-cent premium plus the fuel cost. So it was really a matter of MAPCO making that concession, and that just took some time to work that out.
Representative Sun.
Yeah, I'd like to, Mr. Chairman, follow up that same line of questioning. Okay, whose fault is it between MAPCO and GVA on that? I mean, what hung up the negotiations?
Well, it was a three-party negotiation, as I said. I suppose some of the fault, so to speak, could be pledged with the state, since we insisted on receiving of what we felt was necessary to protect the interests of the state. So I don't know if really say there was a fault. I'm sure the other parties approached it from their perspectives and tried to negotiate the best deal they could for their interests.
Chairman, if I could follow up that, if I could just translate that, Kay, that meant MAPCO was trying to make the state eat the Amerada Hess adjustments then?
Right. I think you'd have to keep in mind that those adjustments were previously borne by Golden Valley. And at a point in the negotiations, Golden Valley said, we're not going to be able to have this adjustment on our contract any longer because the APUC will not allow us to make these retroactive adjustments beyond 1 year. So there were a number of proposals considered at that point, including that the state should make up that difference, or that perhaps MAPCO should make up that difference. And so it seemed to Golden Valley that they were not in a position to make up the difference, and it seemed to us that the state would be not kept whole if we made it up. So we waited it out for MAPCO to agree to make up the difference, understanding that there was something MAPCO wanted out of the negotiations, but that being a successful sale or conclusion of the negotiations and move forward with a contract of which they would be one of the beneficiaries.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to follow up on that. If I can just follow this through, we have a lawsuit going on that says that if we're successful, they owe us some money. MAPCO attempted to say, even if you win, GVA should carry it because you have a pass-through on your contract. GVA can't pass it back, so they said, well, why don't the state, why don't you pick it up? And there was apparently some negotiations. My question is, did the state pay any price in terms of concessions in the price that we're going to sell this fuel at to MAPCO, in turn for MAPCO's agreement to pick up what may, in fact, be an obligation of theirs anyway?
Representative Sund, the price that we paid, so to speak, was giving up the return oil option, which we had previously negotiated into the contract. I'm sure the committee is familiar with how that works, that the oil is processed at the refinery, and then the part that is not made into product is returned to the line. That's the so-called return oil. That return oil emerges again at Valdez as whole oil, and the shipper pays a penalty for having degraded the overall quality of the oil in the line. So we did agree that as long as MAPCO would pick up the MROD ahead adjustments for GVEA's portion, that we would not exercise our option to purchase back the return oil. So that was a concession that we made in order to get the negotiations off dead center.
What does that mean?
Representative Davis.
Well,
turn mic.
I have a question that's on a different topic, but that.
Turn your mic on, if you would, please.
There you go, buddy.
I have a question on a different topic, Mr. Chairman, for Senator Coghill, and that has to do with the comments you made earlier about the drafting of this was to be made more constitutional, and perhaps we can have legal counsel address that. If you don't want to address that, we can wait till.
Well, that's fine. If the reason for the committee substitute, as I understand it, Representative Davis, was to go in and take those particular sections of the bill and address it on the legislative side rather than to pierce the constitutionality of doing it by extending a contract that we really didn't have in front of us.
It's dollars and cents, but we figured it out.
Representative Davis, go ahead.
If I could follow up on that, and perhaps it's something that Kay could address. There has been certainly some people that have felt that this was an attempt to leverage the state in consideration of the contract, but I'm not taking a position on that one way or the other. But isn't there any emergency regulations within the department that which would allow you to provide the oil to Golden Valley MAPCO if there was a gap of 30 days?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, there is not any mechanism by which we can continue to provide oil to Golden Valley beyond June 30th of this year. We are already operating there under a provision in the law that allows us to make a sale for up to 1 year without legislative approval. And that was done previously. That one-year contract expires in June 30th, and there is no provision or no legal way for us to continue that sale beyond that point without the express approval of the legislature.
Thank you.
Representative Szymanski.
Okay, let's go back one more time to pick up where you left off in this saga related to the negotiations, and what was the final deal cut with MAPCO? When you say you gave up the provision to, I guess, or the agreement not to execute your option to buy back, what's that equate to in dollars?
Mr. Chairman, I'm really not sure what that equates to in dollars. It might not equate to any dollars. It's going to be an option for us to purchase back return oil. I think the circumstances that we and other people may have envisioned when that type of an option would be beneficial would be if there was a shortage of products or shortage of supply at other refineries, and we wanted to have the ability to use that oil twice, so to speak, or if there were to be, you know, some other reason for it. It's never been all that apparent why the state would want to exercise the return oil option. There are some real practical difficulties with that approach. However, we felt that it was an option worth trying to put into the contract so that the state would have that flexibility in the future, could become more important in the future as the production curve declines from Prudhoe Bay.
Well, why would they not want it in the contract? Let me go another way.
Well, it's not in their present long-term contract. The state has no control over the return oil in that, under that contract, nor do we have any under the present Golden Valley contract. So I guess it's just never been in there, and it's definitely a benefit to MAPCO to be able to use that return oil again for the purposes of gaining additional supply for their refinery.
Representative Sun.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I realize we have two issues here. One is a continuation for 3 months on this one. I have a proposed letter of intent I would like the committee to address and pass. I think it's in your packet, which basically says passage of this legislation is in no way to be construed as tacit approval or endorsement of having given to the proposed 10-year royalty oil contract of GVA. The 10-year contract shall be reviewed exclusively on its own merits at such time as this contract is presented to the legislature. With that letter of intent, I do not have any real objection to this piece of legislation to continue the existing one. But I tell you, I have some real serious questions regarding the GVA royalty oil contract coming up here that I, not necessarily in favor or against, but I am like Representative Szymanski. The value of that return oil has some value because, as Amaretta Hessen, if I understand the testimony, the GVA could have been on the hook for up to $10 to $12 million. And one company doesn't agree to take somebody out for that kind of money without getting something in return, and I don't quite understand the value they got back on it. So I'm going to reserve a lot of my questions here till we get the royalty oil contract, but I can put you on warning now. There's going to be a long, serious set of questions between here with MAPCO and GVA until at least I personally understand what the contract says.
Senator Coghill, have you had a chance to look at the letter of intent, comment on it?
No, Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen the letter of intent, but I have no problem with what the representative had indicated, because that's the fear that I had all the way following this bill through, is that they were going to get short-circuited between the two, and all we're trying to do is keep the utility in the Fairbanks Delta Healy area in place, and we'll argue the contract on its merit. This contract that we're extending for 3 months was the one that you folks argued last year.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to respond to Representative Sun's comments that there were two issues here. I'd like to offer a suggestion that there's a third. Then I'll speak the same thing that I've mentioned on at least one previous occasion in the Resources Committee. Perhaps in front of a larger audience, somebody might provide me with an answer to the question. I'm not certain why the legislature is involved at all in oil and royalty gas sales, and I'd like somebody to provide me with some information that explains that to me, be that answer come from DNR or be it come from my colleagues in the House or the Senate. But from my perspective, this is an area that I don't find any justification for our involvement in, and I still have yet to understand why we're involved. Thank you.
Representative Cotton.
Well, I'm not sure if I can give a total answer to Representative Thompson's questions, but there is a statute that requires the legislature to be involved, and that's one reason why we're involved. But I also had a question for Kay Brown, which I think she could answer in just one or two words. When should the legislature expect to see the proposed GVA contract, the 10-year contract?
Any moment, as far as I know. It was to have been introduced on the 11th. I understand it was not, but it should be along at any moment.
Thank you. Additional questions? Representative for landscaping.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman, distinguished representative from Interior Alaska, distinguished senator from Interior Alaska. Let me just, for the record, indicate my concern with the overall relationship which we've established with MAPCO and its operations in Interior Alaska, and the I think the representative of Southeastern has adequately articulated my concern, is, and I'm going to be really hard-pressed to continue to support a contract that has been developed, which does not, from at least my perspective, have all answers on the table before, so we understand what the real impact of it's going to be and the downline impact. You know, I look at this buyback provision, and I may want to suggest that that could restrain other refineries from being developed in the Fairbanks area, because if somebody turns around and says, okay, why can't we use the throughput or the residual buyback provision to start up another initial cracking plant, I don't know. But there's a lot of complications to it. I'm not overly impressed with the fact that we're simply going to be subsidizing the Golden Valley Electric Co-op up there, and at the same time subsidizing MAPCO. I think MAPCO's got a real good agreement going, and it's been going for a long time, and I'm not going to enhance it one iota unless there's a real good compelling reason to do it. So I look forward to dealing with the overall contracts, and I'm going to reserve my call on this extension for a little while.
Are there any additional questions? Thank you. Any additional comments? Thank you, Senator Cogger. Well, do we have anyone else signed up?
No.
Okay. Very good. At this time, we have the Resource Committee has the bill before them, and comments among the committee members of Resources.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the CS for Senate Bill 152, Resources, with individual recommendations on the basis that I would like the committee also to look at the letter of intent, because I'd like to move that along with the letter of intent along with the bill in one motion.
Are there objections to House Bill or Senate Bill 152 passing from the Resources Committee with the letter of intent? If not,
Okay.
I would assume that at this time that the people still in Anchorage still want to participate in the teleconference with House Bill 267. Okay, so that'll be it for the teleconference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
You guys get to leave now. Stick around, of course. Over in the parks. User fees here.
Hey, take care of the Southeastern Parks. Will you
we have a sign up?
Hey, we're just trying to create a couple.
Right. You guys want to locate? Yeah.
John, I'm going to pick these. Mike, grab sand.
Okay, we have House Bill 267 before us. It's an act related to the levy of funding fees for the use of state park facilities. There's a fiscal note that's in your positive, I might add. Positive fiscal note. You don't see many of those. Anyway, it's with the bill. And here we have today to testify on this legislation, Neil Johansson, who's the director of State Parks. You don't need to worry about the teleconference, so we're off.
Mr. Chairman, members of the House Resources Committee, good morning. I'm Neil Johansson, Director of State Parks for Alaska. And I'm here to testify on House Bill 267, which is a measure which was introduced by this committee, and I'd like to present some brief comments on why I think this is a good bill. Alaskans participate in outdoor recreation activities at twice the national average. We hunt, we fish, we camp, we hike and ski, as if the population of Alaska were more like 1 million people than 500,000 people. In addition, the state has spent annually approximately $8 million in the Division of Tourism budget to attract visitors to the state. In fact, the tourism industry is generally considered to be the third largest industry in the state. In addition to the money that the state spends on attracting visitors to the state has been spending approximately $6 million annually to maintain and operate approximately 100 units of the state park system. Last year, those 110 units of the state park system attracted approximately 5 million visitors, and about 1 million or 1 in 20 of those visitors was a non-resident visitor visiting either historic sites or state recreation sites or using our campgrounds. The state over the last 20 years has constructed or taken over through land selections from the Bureau of Land Management approximately 2,000 campsites, which are on the road system. Those 2,000 campsites last year hosted approximately 2.5 million overnight visitors. At this point in time, the Alaska State Park System is the only state park system of the 50 state park systems in the United States which has no fee program at all. I would like to now offer some reasons why I believe that this would be a good measure to bring into law this session. It's no secret that there is a serious decline in the petroleum royalty oil income to the state. We spend a considerable sum of money to support the park and recreation and tourism program in the state, and put very simply, this measure would generate some significant revenues to the state to offset the cost of providing this very popular program. In addition, I believe that an argument can be established and forwarded that those who derive the direct benefit of a program which is provided by the state should probably offset some of the costs of it. In other words, for those who do not camp in or utilize the 2,000 campsites that the state maintains and operates, there would be essentially a reduction in the per visitor subsidy of the program, because those who actually use the program would essentially pay for or attempt to offset some of the cost of it. In addition, in the state of Alaska, there are a number of public and private campgrounds, obviously, that are offered by public agencies and private corporations. The U.S. Forest Service provides a rather active program of campgrounds in the state, as does the National Park Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There are a number of municipal campgrounds in the state. All of these other agencies have campground fees. To utilize Forest Service campgrounds, as an example, cost approximately $6 per night to offset the maintenance and operation costs of their programs. One of the substantial arguments in the 2 years that I have been state park director has come from the private campground operators. There's a substantial number of private campground operators in the state of Alaska who have been consistently critical of the state and other agencies, or the state that is, for essentially providing free competition. In particular, there are some campgrounds along the Alaska Highway in the Token Delta area and in the edge of Fairbanks that have been particularly critical of the state continuing to offer essentially free competition. Some of the other arguments that I believe should be advanced also, in other states it has been shown that where there are some program receipts that are generated from an otherwise expensive program, lawmakers often tend to be a little bit friendlier towards the budget of the agency that provides those programs. In other words, instead of simply making the annual pitch before the finance committees for the funds to maintain and operate this program, we have the potential for putting some money back on the table to reduce the per visitor subsidy of this program. Recreation research across the United States, Mr. Chairman, has shown that where people pay to use a fair sum, paid to use facilities, that there is a substantial reduction in vandalism and other erosive behavior in public recreation facilities. And as an example, in the Kenai Peninsula, we have approximately $1,000 per week in vandalism consistently on the state park units that we have now in the Kenai. And we believe that if there would be a more appreciative attitude which would be developed on the part of the users if they were to be offsetting some of the costs of this program. And as I've mentioned, we would anticipate that vandalism and other destructive behavior would be reduced. From the standpoint of some of the concerns which have been advanced about the expense of actually providing this program, how much would you spend a dollar to collect a dollar, the U.S. Forest Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the province of British Columbia, other state park agencies have perfected a program which is called the Iron Ranger system, which is essentially a self-registration program in which the users of the campgrounds essentially pay the fees into the self-registration system. We would anticipate that within approximately 3 years, this program would be costing approximately $50,000 per year and would generate in excess of $500,000. As I mentioned earlier, approximately 20% of those who use the state park system are non-residents of Alaska. The tourism industry is a substantial industry in the state, generally considered to be the third largest. Approximately 700,000 non-residents visited Alaska last year and spent over $500 million in the state. That's not the cost to buy the plane tickets or the other fares to get here. This was an expenditure of over $500 million once they reached the state. We also believe that if we can generate some program receipts and then use that as a linkage in the finance committees, that it will go a long way towards preventing or trying to preclude the possibility of having to eventually, because of declining budgets, to have reduced services to prevent the overflowing garbage cans, the poorly maintained restrooms, and the possibility of locked gates in the campgrounds of the state by having program receipts. We believe, and to basically conclude my remarks, we believe that this is a good process. It's a good bill. We support the bill. It will bring a down-to-business approach, a business-like management program to the state park system. We also don't have any doubt that there will be some controversy associated with it, but Mr. Chairman, I would advance that the time has come to begin trying to offset the cost of this program, to reduce the per-visitor subsidy of this program through some program receipts.
Thank you. Representative Cato.
Neil, Mr. Johansson, I understand what you're saying. I have a few problems with this, such as the Iron Ranger you're talking about, and I would assume this is something like the Diamond parking lots throughout the state where they have a slot to put your money in.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cato, that's probably a pretty good analogy, although we don't plan to lock barrels to the bumpers of the Winnebagoes if they don't pay.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think my biggest problem has to do with actually what you said. What does it take to collect a dollar? We have a municipal campsite in Valdez, and I do know that it's extremely expensive to try to collect anything on, so 9 times out of 10 they don't even bother. So I'm just curious really as to the maintenance, the amount of money. I'm afraid I can't agree with you that the program will pay for itself. As I said, even though you don't propose to put barrels on the bumpers, I know a great many people that will pull into alongside one of those Iron Rangers and just ignore it. And really, what device do we have to insist they pay it? How do we know they've even been there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cato, we did a substantial survey of other state park systems of the province of British Columbia and the Forest Service on the compliance with the self-registration system, and we came up with some interesting figures. All the campgrounds that are now offered by British Columbia, and there are substantial numbers of campgrounds that they now have constructed, are using a self-registration Iron Ranger system. They have found that they are getting 80% compliance, and with limited staff contact with the campers, that jumps to 96%. The U.S. Forest Service in Alaska is getting 77% compliance with their self-registration Iron Ranger system, and with the use of campground hosts or limited staff contact, that jumps to 92%. The previous place where I worked, which was another state park system, we had used the Iron Rangers, and we had very, very high compliance rate, in excess of 80%. Essentially the program was already being used successfully in Alaska. And as a matter of fact, the campground that you mentioned in Valdez, I would urge that if they're trying to or have any interest in trying to offset the cost of that program, that an Iron Ranger program with limited contact would be a very successful program. Other states have had a lot of success with it.
Lieutenant Miller.
Neil, I have a question for you, and I see in this little from the Department of Natural Resources, proposing charging $6 for overnight use for a resident, $8 for non-resident, and I basically have no problem with that. I think when we ran into problems before was the concept that we might be charging families that might be going to the campground for an afternoon picnic. And I think this is where some of the controversies developed before. And what is your concept of that? Or basically, you're just looking at charging for overnight usage versus the family or a group of people that want to go to the campground for a two-hour picnic?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, I don't think that the state park system should have a day use fee. I think that for those who want to go skiing for the day or to dig a bucket of clams or fish or launch a boat or whatever, that there should be no fees. I think that if we were to get involved in day use fees, that it really would break the bank if we were to have a collection program. For those who want to use a campground along the Alaska Highway or some other area just for a picnic, I think there should be no fees. The essential cost that we run into is the construction, the maintenance and operation, the hauling of the trash, et cetera, with the campgrounds. And across the United States right now, and we've done some substantial research before we worked with the committee on this bill, all state park systems in the United States right now are collecting approximately 25% of their operating costs through fees. And the program is an expensive one. A new large campground can easily cost $800,000 to build with road systems and water systems, et cetera. And what we're trying to do is simply recover some of the operating costs of the camping program.
Representative Sun.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just initially let you know where I'm not really in favor of this legislation. But and one of the reasons what Representative Miller brought up, I don't see anything in the bill, Neil, that distinguishes between day use fees and overnight fees. There just isn't, the word isn't even in the legislation.
Mr. Chairman, I would have no problem with trying to shape an amendment which would make it very clear that this is simply to offset some of the cost of the maintenance and the operation of the state's camping program.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, follow up a little bit. What's your total overall budget for the park system?
Approximately $6 million a year to operate about 100 units.
Okay, and you're proposing, what, $100,000 in a revenue source here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sun, the first-year startup costs are always higher than the continuation costs. It's necessary to buy the Iron Rangers, the signboards, some safes, and some of the more remote ranger stations. But that cost then slips downward in the years ahead as we've established the program. We would anticipate in approximately 3 years, revenues of about $500,000 against a cost of around $59,000.
Okay, if I may, Mr. Chairman, just so I understand the fiscal note. The fiscal note, the whole cost of starting this whole program is netted out of the first year's receipts. Is that why there's no capital cost in the fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sund, we thought that we could avoid having a capital item. And instead, things like safes and the signboards and stuff would be supplies under operating and not capital.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, I just want to know where it shows up in your budget. The whole cost of putting this program together, yeah.
It's part of the fiscal note. It would not appear in the budget unless the bill were passed. If the bill were passed into law, the fiscal note would also take effect unless reduced or eliminated.
And I guess I'll just close out, Mr. Chairman, saying I'm just not really into the every item that we have in the state has to be on a user fee basis. I think there's some items that do not have to be on user fee basis. And if we went to a user fee system and applied it across the board, we'd be in deep trouble in a lot of budget items. And I disagree that the day has come that we have to charge to use our campgrounds in this state. And for that reason, I'm going to oppose the legislation.
Maybe we could amend it and put Marine Parks in. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Had a zero fiscal note on that, Mr. Chairman.
I would like to comment on this bill and speak in support of it. I also would like to go one step beyond and thank Mr. Johansson for advancing this concept. And I have to respectfully disagree with the representative from Ketchikan, who doesn't feel the day has come when we need to start taking the initiative, finding ways of generating new revenue sources, and that includes putting things on a user fee basis. I am very pleased that the bureaucracy that, in my short experience, has led me to believe is constantly thinking up ways to spend money is, in this instance, trying to figure out ways to generate money. And I applaud Mr. Johansson's initiative in this respect. I have no problem whatever with putting our parks on a user fee basis, and that would extend to including a daytime user fee, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that the message that needs to be conveyed to the people of this state regarding this bill and several others that are before us this session is, yes, indeed, the day has come when we must recognize that there are going to be some very definite changes in the way this state is run. In my estimation, we have indeed reached a point where we can no longer support the services, we can no longer support all the programs that we currently have in place with the revenues that we currently are taking in. So there very definitely is going to be a need for some changes. I'm very supportive of this bill, and I would like to encourage my colleagues, as well as those like Mr. Johansson, who serve the people of this state in the bureaucracy, to figure out other ways to generate additional revenues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jenkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johansson, last year this proposed legislation was in front of this body. Is that not true? I've heard today a couple of comments, both from a philosophical basis and an economic one, as to why there was opposition. Can you inform me as to what other forms of opposition you encountered last year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jenkins, the opposition last year, in all honesty, took the shape of why do we have to generate revenues off of a program when there's an abundance of revenue to operate the system. I believe that there's been a substantial change between the atmosphere in the legislature last year and this year, and I really truly believe, as a professional park manager, that we need to begin generating revenues to offset the cost of this program.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with the concept of charging for overnight fees. However, I do not agree for charging day fees. So if possible, Mr. Chairman, I would like to see the staff be able to maybe draw up amendments and specifically say in the bill that there will not be day fees charged in our campground system.
Mr. Chairman,
do you hear the comment?
Mr. Chairman, a reading of the of House Bill 267 before you makes it fairly clear, in my opinion, that the bill is exclusively for the levying of campground fees. If I could have the committee's attention for a second, Section 4121023, fees for the use of state park campsites. A, the department may establish and collect fees for the use of state park developed campsites. It makes no reference to any other type of fee. And since there was a law passed, I think it was in 1978, I believe, Alaska Statute 2810.411 prohibited any kind of state park fees. This would only authorize campground fees. With always the danger of trying to practice law without a license, my understanding is that this would really apply only to campgrounds, since other fees are already prohibited.
You have a question for
Yes, I do, Michelle. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johansson, I don't have a problem with charging fees for parks. I'm curious as to how you're going to decide whether it be...
Representative Pierce, we would use a program that has been implemented, or to use a similar program which has been implemented by the U.S. Forest Service here, which would essentially use an envelope process, and the charge would be for vehicles, which it's pretty hard for a vehicle to have dual identity from the standpoint of its license plate. So we feel that there might be perhaps a mixture of Alaskans and non-Alaskans in a camping party, but the fee is really oriented and aimed at being a fee for vehicles in the campgrounds.
So if I could go ahead. So if I fly to Alaska and rent a car and come in because it'll have Alaska tags, I'll be paying a resident fee.
Mr. Chairman, essentially that would be true. That would be true, since the charge really has to be oriented towards a vehicle. And the compliance checks, the spot checks by park rangers and volunteers in the campgrounds would have to be to the license plates. That would be a very difficult problem to prevent.
Follow up on that. I really don't see the distinction between non-Alaskans and Alaskans. I have difficulty, even with your Iron Ranger situation, of charging non-Alaskans, say $2 more, to use exactly the same facility, merely because they're non-Alaskans. Again, I'm not sure that we wouldn't hit something like the fact the Mobile Society has a right to travel and therefore not be charged any more than any other part of the Mobile Society. I really don't think that the distinction is necessary. I don't think that extra $2 is going to gain that much revenue.
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment on Representative Cato's remarks, those are excellent remarks. The state, as you know, charges a different fee for hunting and fishing licenses, residents versus non-residents. And the reason that this proposal is advanced, and frankly it does not appear in the legislation, because I think that we need to really perhaps examine it and the reaction that we get against the tourism industry, et cetera, the basic philosophy behind it is similar to what the state park system in Oregon has done, in which the residents of a state pay a far higher cost for the development of those campgrounds, the allocation of land for those campgrounds, the maintenance and operation cost for the program, and therefore the argument has followed that since the residents are already more involved in the support of those programs than the non-residents, that there should be a surcharge to make up the difference. The state of Oregon, again, looking at other examples nationwide, the state of Oregon has a $2 surcharge on non-residents for its camping program. Director of Oregon State Parks, Dave Talbot, who is a friend of mine, and I have discussed this at some length, and he claims that there has been no impact at all in the tourism industry or a lot of negative reaction from the non-residents in the use of those campgrounds by having a non-resident surcharge.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to, again, lend my support to Mr. Johansson's position, which I find an interesting development in itself, but be that as it may, I have no problem with charging non-Alaskans more money, and I think it does follow. In my mind, the best example there is that the practice has long been established relative to state universities and having non-resident fees, and it has never been challenged on constitutional grounds, and very appropriate for the very reasons that Mr. Johansson mentioned. So I'm very supportive of the tourism industry, but I do believe that this will not in any way negatively impact tourism. And I would also suggest that, as far as that goes, that the people who come in from outside have long since gotten into the habit of paying for services, that Alaskans are really a privileged class in that respect. And again, I think the day will shortly come when we realize we're not a privileged class, but rather we have to pay for those things that we use like everybody else does. And, so I have no problem with that provisions of the bill either. How did I get in this position anyway, Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thompson, you had a bad cold when we discussed this before. I'm not really sure that you or I understand it.
I think Representative Sun, as our lawyer, has got some information for you.
Well, I have a couple questions. Section 3, you have an immediate effective date on this. Is there any reason why that is? It's going to take you some time to adopt regulations to put this into effect and also to acquire equipment. Why is it necessary for this to go into effect immediately?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sun, we believe it will be possible to have some of the larger, more modern campgrounds in the state park system under a fee program before the end of the coming summer.
Okay. Second item, Mr. Chairman, Section 2, the repealers, just for the committee's benefit, the 2810-411E is a provision in the motor registration section which says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, the fees paid for registering a vehicle shall include all fees required for entry into and use of a state park or campground, and that was put in last year. So how rapidly we are moving here.
Mr. Chairman, that law went into effect in 1978.
Right. And it was amended last year, I believe.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, just for my satisfaction of mind, I'd like to make an amendment to the bill. On line 12, between the words the and use, I'd like to insert the word overnight. So the bill would read, the department may establish and collect fees for the overnight use of state parks, developed campsites.
Mr. Chairman, I would have no objection to that.
There is a amendment before us to adopt overnight on line 12 between the and use. Comments? Go ahead, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask Mr. Johansson if that creates an additional burden in terms of regulation and oversight here. Are we asking our park rangers to get into tent checks with this, or what?
I don't know. Maybe that could be a volunteer service.
I guess I walked into that.
You're having a hard day today.
That's two, Mr. Chairman.
Any objections to the adoption of that amendment? Hearing none, that amendment has been adopted.
Yeah, Neil, I understand that the department has is looking at developed campsites, and I want to know if you know what your intention is, if you have any intention of getting into any other kind of fees for just, you know, parks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Herman, we do have some intentions of getting involved in other fees and parks. We already are investigating the possibility of public use cabins. We have approximately 20 cabins in the state park system already that were acquired through the years, and we believe those should be available to the public on a nightly rental basis, similar to the cabin program that the U.S. Forest Service operates. In addition, one other area that we are investigating fees is for tours of developed historical sites, and perhaps an example in Ketchikan would be appropriate. State park system has the largest collection of totemic art, totem poles, clan house, etc., at Totem Bight State Historical Park in Ketchikan, which is visited by approximately 50,000 non-resident visitors a year, just as an example. It's an expensive program to maintain the art collection there. We are investigating the possibility of having a fee, which would not be collected directly from the tourists as they would arrive at this historical park, but rather would be a fee levied through the large tour companies such as Alaska Sightseeing, Gray Line, West Tours, etc. As they would roll in with a tour bus, we would maintain counts, and a fee would later be levied to a contract arrangement with the large tour companies.
Chairman, if I could, Neil, why don't you already have that under the historical sites fee provision? And see, that would be, where I'm just reading it in here, 4135, I believe, where you are allowed to charge a fee for visiting historical sites.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sun, we are planning to implement that program, not this summer, but next summer. That law just went into effect this past year, and after investigating it, we have found that because of previous bookings, the establishment of fees already for the coming spring season, the first tour ships arrive in Ketchikan in only a couple of months, that it would be unfair to levy a fee when they've already established their fee schedules and done their bookings at this point, but that we would work with them this coming fall prior to the 1986 season, so they would have time to prepare for the cost of that against their cost.
We do have another person to testify.
I have one more question, Mr. Johansson. I'm looking at the fiscal note. The intention of personnel services, $31,000 fiscal year 86 and $38,000 in fiscal year 87 through 90. Is it correct to that those figures reveal that there would be one person impact total, and that would be in your intention for the ensuing 5 years, and no other personnel services?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jenkins, we anticipate the addition of only one part-time staff person, and that would be in the Division of Management, and would be an accounting technician to handle the cash accounting of the program. The additional personal services above and beyond a part-time accounting technician would be overtime for the field staff so they can handle the field accounting function and also, in some cases, drive the receipts some distance to get to the closest bank. Some of the parks are fairly remote along some of the remoter stretches of the highway, and to once a week carry that cash in, we believe we need a little bit of overtime.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. So it would be one person and overtime, and that's all for the next 5 years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jenkins, that is true.
Write that down.
Right. Thank you, Neil. Just take a poll. If we want to discuss this bill among ourselves here for a minute, they got to get that camera out before Scott comes up and testify here. Scott, you might as well come on up and get your name for the record and what have you. It'll be a little promotion here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Heilman with the Alaska Environmental Lobby. Would you like me to go ahead?
Certainly. All right. Go ahead.
Thank you, sir. Tourism is the state's third largest industry, with all projections pointing to continued growth in visitor expenditures. The Alaska State Parks host to 4 million visits annually and are credited with sponsoring 100 million tourist dollars each year. Although the State of Alaska Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation has had an annual user fee in the past, it has never had a camping fee, the only state in the nation without a user fee system. House Bill 267 would institute user fees on a limited basis. The Alaska Environmental Lobby supports the concept of this bill. House Bill 267 proposes fees for per-night campsite use, as amended. The program would be initiated on a few developed campgrounds, as you heard, with charges for overnight camping, not for typical day use activities. To sustain the reputation of our state parks and to keep our parks contributing to the tourism industry, increased support for park operations and maintenance costs is vital. House Bill 267 is a reasonable attempt to recoup some of the state's investment in our state parks. We believe user groups should be asked to help defray costs of providing developed public recreation sites for their benefit. Experience has shown the public expects to pay for such facilities and services. Additionally, the payoff shown in other areas with similar programs, as you heard today, includes decreased vandalism in the parks. While we support the concept of a user fee system, we have several concerns which should be addressed before instituting this program. Excessive fees would be unacceptable. Park fee schedules should be established only after adequate public hearings and should not be set so as to exclude people. However, we feel reasonable fees will be to everyone's benefit. Exemptions or special provisions should be made for special user groups such as senior citizens or those not able to afford the park fees. Also, provisions should be made to offer a yearly pass. This would be less expensive for frequent park users, and thus would tend to favor Alaskans. And finally, I noticed on House Bill 267 has a misdemeanor clause, which was not included in the previous bills in the last 2 years. I'm not sure that that's really necessary if we're talking about voluntary compliance. The intent of this legislation is not to exclude people from state parks, but to provide modest public support for this popular program. We feel public acceptance will be favorable, and the environmental lobby on behalf of environmental organizations statewide supports this program.
Representative Cato.
I knew there was something that's been bugging me all the time. Before I came to the committee, I'd read the bill rather thoroughly. What are the ramifications of a misdemeanor? And I think John is probably the one to address the question.
I could probably answer you on this one. It's not to exceed $1,000 and not more than 6 months. And I guess that's a... not too bad, I guess. 6 months in jail for failing to pay the $6 fee at the when Representative Thompson was searching the tent at night. could develop it more than that, but I guess I would question that. Why don't we just go to an infraction system or a citation system? But I'm not really in favor of the legislation anyway. So,
but wouldn't it be safe to assume that if a person did not pay the fee and they were caught and they were taken to court and they were given the maximum penalty, they probably wouldn't do it again.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to propose an amendment. And the amendment is that we delete line 21 through line 22. I think it's an absolute outrage to put that type of penalty on someone, and I don't know how you're going to catch them to begin with.
You, if I may, shouldn't there be something in there for an infraction that they have to...
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just to give you an example of what would happen here is that under the misdemeanor citation, the person who's fails or presumably fails to pay is cited, and not only cited but served with a complaint, misdemeanor complaint, and at that time has a choice to either defend themselves or not, go hire a lawyer, go to court against the attorney general or the district attorney, and if it was an outrageous filing or a bad filing, whatever, the judge says, well, geez, they made a mistake and I'm going to dismiss this, or I'll give you a $50 fine or the 6-month SIS, suspended imposition of sentence. So the person, nothing happens to him except you paid $1,000 in attorney's fees to get that far. And I wasn't going to take it out because I was going to use that on the floor of the House, but I don't want the legislation anyway. But.
How about the simply imposing a fine, you know, $25 fine or something of that effect, that if they didn't comply and they're caught, you know? Is that?
Well, we do have a citation and infraction system, like your speeding, your vehicle tickets and moving violations. But.
Well, I would still like to put forth my amendment that we delete that line, those two lines.
Neil, do you have any problem with that?
Mr. Chairman, the reason that we thought that that line was important is to have some kind of penalty for those who indeed choose not to pay. The alternative, if that were to be stricken from the bill, I suspect would be to go through the regulation process, which would take us probably five or six months to establish a penalty. There was a bill passed into law last year which authorized the state Supreme Court to establish a fine schedule for simple park violations to avoid having to hire an attorney, etc., for simple infractions of the law. I'm not an attorney, but what we were simply after was some teeth in this thing. You know, for those who choose not to pay against those who do, there should be some kind of penalty, I believe. Maybe this isn't the most appropriate, but.
Well, those are mighty strong teeth. I'd hate to think that for some reason or other that a person could inadvertently, and this is probably a far-fetched example, forget, not deliberately try to get out of paying a fee, but for some reason or other, family pressure, whatever might be going on, merely forget to, they might fill out the form, then forget to deposit in the Iron Ranger the amount of money, as much as a two-step process. And I would certainly hate to think that we're going to charge somebody something like that, $1,000, 6 months in jail, for perhaps just forgetting. In fact, as I said, I think the idea of a misdemeanor, and I knew I came into the room today spiked with something, which this is what it is, that is excessive and, as I said before, outrageous.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know. I guess us law and order types are in the teeth. I don't know. I do agree that this particular penalty seems to be excessive, but I do feel that some sort of penalty is appropriate. And if Mr. Sund intends to have a good time with this on the floor, then I will serve notice also that I will do my best to see that some sort of penalty is in there, if it's a citation. But I will not support this amendment because I do think there needs to be some sort of penalty.
Okay. Representative Jenkins, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry.
I feel I must support this amendment because I do feel that the testimony I've just heard includes that we can do this by regulation as in terms of a traffic ticket. And then if the person, if a vehicle ends up in our state parks time and time again with tickets time and time again, then maybe we could consider something stronger. But I do not feel that we need this in the legislation.
Representative Herman.
Mr. Chairman, didn't we hear from the department that he said that by regulation they could impose a fine? Is that what you said, Neil? That by regulation you don't need anything in law, but by regulation you were given that authority earlier on or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Herman, that is true. I guess what we were trying to do was to prevent the rather lengthy process of promulgating a regulation related to infractions against this bill should it be signed into law. That it would be clear that, you know, if and when the department establishes a campground fee program, that, you know, would be part of the law, that compliance was necessary. Perhaps some perhaps it'd be possible, again, I'm not an attorney, to lessen the teeth in the act. But I really do think that there should be some kind of penalty for those who do not pay. Same as you have for fishing licenses or whatever.
Neil, aren't you also, to even develop the fee schedule, going to have to promulgate regulations?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sun, perhaps not. You know, this authorizes the establishment of a fee program. Whether that would have to go through a regulation process, I'm not sure. Our intent is to levy the same level of fees that the Forest Service and other agencies in the state, a very commensurate even fee, and not to gouge the public.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would encourage the department to go through the regulation process in establishing these fees and talk to the people and have some hearings on what the fee schedules ought to be, and it accomplishes two things that way. One, you get the public input of what the fee schedule should be, and secondly, you sensitize the public to the fact there is going to be a fee schedule. And just to do it by fiat, I think, would be a bad move. And if that's, then you can do the fine by regulation, too.
Representative Sunday, would it be possible to put a fine in here for those that are caught that do not comply? Is it possible just to put a fee down that people that do not comply are fined $50 or $25 or whatever?
Yeah, I believe that would be possible. I'm not I'm not into legislative drafting, so I think I'd ask a drafter to come up with that theory. But I think you could put some in. I'll just relate to the committee an experience I had under this misdemeanor thing dealing with fish and game. I had some boats, and we're having a dispute whether the sport fishing boats had to be licensed as commercial boats. In other words, have AK numbers on them. We bought the AK numbers from the commission, or limited entry commission, had them in the office. The boats were out fishing without them, and they got cited by Fish and Wildlife for fishing without having the numbers. We said we had a dispute. We ran the boats in, put the numbers on the boats, and went fishing again. And to me, it was something like getting caught driving without your driver's license. You show up, you show you have a license, and it's dismissed. It wasn't dismissed. The DA refused to dismiss it. Fish and Game refused to pull off the charges. We went to court. We had to hire lawyers. The judge, when he got to it, almost laughed at the point, dismissed the charges, and I ended up with a $2,000 attorney bill. And that's the exact same situation that could happen here. And that's why I guess I would support the amendment to delete this provision out. And if you want to replace it with something less, that would be fine.
Representative Sun, I have no problem in taking the amendment out myself. I'm just wondering if we shouldn't put in there a fixed price. So if a person is caught, you know, the person that walks in, catches the person, he can tell them that you know they're in violation of this statute, and it'd be $25
$50
or whatever.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if Mr. Johansson is right, he probably knows his regulations better than I do. If he can impose a fine by regulation, then I would encourage them at the same time they promulgate regulations to put the fees in, that they promulgate regulations to put the fines in. I'm not sure he can do it, but if he thinks he can, that's up to him.
Representative Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We all have AIDS, and not only does mine share knee injuries with me, he also shares his thoughts sometimes. And he pointed out something that I think is a good point that we at least ought to throw on the table, which is that there's very little difference between shoplifting $6 worth of goods from a retail store and shoplifting $6 worth of services from the state. So I feel like there should be some sort of a fine. I think perhaps we should direct drafting people to find a way to put into this bill the ability to have a fine, whether we want to go ahead and say that it's so much money or whether we want to tell the department that they have to provide for a fine, but we need to do something.
What I would like to, okay, if it's possible, I'd like to get some kind of a consensus here as to what kind of a fine you would like to see levied against these people. $50 too much?
Chairman, I don't even want to see a fee levied.
Well, excluding you.
I'm
serious. If the people that would like to see a fine imposed or a fee established for a fine, what kind of a dollar amount are you talking about? Are we talking a $50 fine? Are we talking a $25 fine?
Well, Mr. Chairman, inasmuch as it's very possible, and they already have the authority to levy a fine, I think that should be left up to the division itself in regulation. My primary concern is to take this line 21 and 22 completely out of the bill.
Okay, just one quick question then. Neil, do you have any, do you think you'd have any problem in coming up with a regulation that would address the fine?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. There is a motion before us to remove lines 21 and 22 from this bill at this time, and the feeling that it can be addressed through regulation. Are there objections? One objection. Anyone else? All those in favor vote by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
Nay.
Okay. That has been, the amendment has passed. At this time, are there any other problems with this piece of legislation? You have some subsistence that's coming your way that we're going to be spending quite a bit of time on, and we've got other bills that are going to be put before us. Any requests from the committee as far as this legislation is concerned? Would you like to see it pass out?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass House Bill number 267 out of committee as amended.
With individual recommendations?
Yes.
Are there objections? Hearing none, House Bill 267 has passed by committee.
Make sure when this bill is high floor, I want to
do this.
Actually, for any of these bills, I'm not here.
And tell somebody triggered me.
I'm down here to get my bill.
Oh, we're adjourned.